Okay, I'm not going to talk very long, and I'm not going to say very much about Turgenev, at least not intentionally. But since I was absent last time, but listened to the recording, I was aware of the fact that perhaps a little bit more needs to be said about the emergence of the novel in the roughly 100 years before the Russian novel actually begins to flourish in Gogol and Turgenev. Right, so if you look up here, we have the names of two of the pioneers in the English novel, Henry Fielding and Samuel Richardson. Richardson the older, and Richardson published a first novel in the 1740s called Pamela, or Virtue Rewarded. And this novel was very popular. But as a matter of fact, it is a rather strange novel. You may have studied parts of it if you've ever taken a course in the British novel. Fielding, who had been a dramatist and later became a judge, was at the time not very impressed with Pamela, although he and Richardson, well, he knew Richardson's sisters, as it turns out. Now, Richardson wasn't a writer at all. He was sort of middle class. And you begin to see with these early novelists, you see emerge a new kind of writer who's writing for a new kind of audience. So I want to make you aware of a few shifts now that go on, beginning in the 1740s and into the second half of the 18th century, when the British novel emerges. It's not that the English were the only ones to write novels, but they wrote a particular kind of novel, and this was recognized quite early. By the way, Fielding wrote a parody of Pamela called Shamela. Pamela is a serving girl in the house of a wealthy family, and she is pursued by the son of the widowed mother, who has taken a special care of Pamela, who comes from parents who are very lower class, but simple, good folk, but not very well educated. She's taken as a young girl in the household, and she becomes then a serving girl, but the lady of the manor sort of takes her under her wing, makes sure she can read and that she has proper manners and all of this. As she grows into her teens, the young master, the son of the lady of the manor, takes an interest in her, and this is something you find a great deal of. His mother dies, and at that point, it's open season on serving girls for young masters who are feeling their oats. The whole novel, which goes on at some length, is in letters. It's an epistolary novel, and it's the story of Pamela's resistance of the young master's advances, which turn into a kidnapping and all sorts of things. Finally, he gives up and marries her, which is not the thing to do. That is, you're not supposed to marry serving girls. But everybody admits that she has a certain almost aristocratic air about her. Everybody's charmed by her. And in the end, he realizes that he was right to marry her. And then the second volume, then we get the problem with his sister, who resents Pamela, and there's a conflict between Pamela and the sister. So the novel is built on conflict very early on. Fielding, however, Richardson comes out of the blue, pretty much. I mean, he's got characters that you didn't see in prose fiction previously, not very much except in the picaresque novel, maybe. And There were epistolary fictions before this, but not quite on this scale ever, and not set in a country house like this. It's set in an ordinary environment. Richardson's work was read all over Europe, and it had quite an impact. And the French, well, encyclopédiste, he was one of the founders of the encyclopedia in France, Denis Diderot, wrote an essay called In Praise of Richardson, which was published in 1762. So I want to read you just a little bit of this and a little bit of another work from 1785 to give you a sense of what was understood by the novel and why, for a good 100 years before we get to Dead Souls, it had captured the attention of a new literary audience. So in other words, these are new readers in some ways. They were people before this. Alexander Pope had said in the 1720s, our wives read Milton and our daughters plays. Now, the rest of the men read Latin and Greek if they were educated. And the wives read Paradise Lost because they couldn't read Latin or Greek. And the daughters, well, read plays. The popular fare was published plays. Now, Diderot says, by novel, we have until now understood a tissue of fantastic and frivolous events which presented a threat to the taste and morals of its readers. Fantasy lit, as it were. That's because in French, the word for novel still is roman, which is, of course, the same as the word romance. There was no distinction, and to this day, there are not separate terms for novel and romance. But there were in English. And this is to address the question of the two different words that you see in Russian, both of which might be translated by the English novel, all right? There's also skaz, but that's a different term altogether. All right, so he says, I should like another name to be found for the works of Richardson, because roman is associated with the fantastic romance, the love romance, which was an aristocratic form and the descendant of the medieval romances. Another name to be found for the works of Richardson, which raise the spirit, touch the heart, are permeated with a love for what is good, and are also called novels. In French translation, that is. So he goes on to say of Richardson, after a number of other things, this author does not send blood flowing down the walls. He does not transport you to distant lands. He does not expose you to being eaten by savages. He does not confine himself within the secret haunts of debauchery. He never wanders off into the world of fantasy. The world we live in is his scene of action. His drama is anchored in truth. His people are as real as it is possible to be. His characters are taken from the world of society. His events belong to the customs of all civilized nations. The passions he portrays are those I feel within me. The same things arouse them, and I recognize their force in myself. The problems and afflictions of his people are the same kind as those which constantly hang over me. He shows me the general course of life as I experience it. Without this art, my mind would easily take to the paths of fantasy. There would be only a fleeting illusion and a faint passing impression. And he goes on to say, I've observed that amongst people who read Richardson together or separately, the conversation was all the more interesting and lively. people talked about these things because they seemed to be directly related to their own lives. I have heard, as a consequence of their reading, the most important questions concerning morality and taste being discussed and analyzed. I have heard the conduct of the characters being discussed in the same way that one would discuss real events. So the novel then was taken as something you could talk about exactly in the same way that you talk about experiences that people had had. And one of the rules in the beginning of the novel was not that there couldn't be coincidences or adventures or the rest, it was that there could be no evidence, no explanations that depended on the supernatural. Everything has to have a natural explanation. Even Dostoevsky, convinced Christian as he is, anytime there is anything that happens that might be attributed to a miracle or something else, there is an alternative natural explanation for it. Right? So this is the world of the novel. So, interestingly enough, in the second half of the 18th century, in England and in France, as a matter of fact, there was a ready audience for the novels and the beginnings of a group of literary critics who were women, because the novels tended to be domestic in their world. The world that the novel describes in Richardson, he was a man, but with the exception of his last novel, his heroines are women. And despite the fact that in Clarissa, which is really long, you think these Russian novels are long, you should read Clarissa. And oh boy, is it slow reading. And it's also in letters. And Clarissa dies at the end. It's an extravagant, yeah. No, it's inevitable, I suppose. She's carried off by a rake named Lovelace, and a kind of Byronic hero before its time. And she dies at the end, but it takes her 90 pages to die. Of course, the novel is 1,500 pages long, so you hardly notice, right? The first British attempt at a history of the novel was written by a woman by the name of Clara Reeve. She wrote a book called The Progress of Romance in 1785. It's a series of dialogues on the history of prose fiction. And in it, she judged the novel to be superior to the older form of the romance, precisely because of its great similitude to actual existence. Before this time, you see, you wrote about people of high degree. You didn't write about ordinary things because everybody knew about ordinary things. Literature was about the extraordinary, about things that didn't happen to you. Now we're suddenly interested in things that happened to us. So she points out that the romance is a heroic fable, she says, of fabulous persons and things. The novel, she defines in one of these dialogues, as a picture of real life and manners and of the times in which it is written. So the romance is always cast back to remote times, to a never-never world, or once upon a time, and all of this. This is in our time. There is the historical novel, but that was a later development, actually. Well, more or less. There is one exception. All right. And she says, its perfection resides in representing scenes in so easy and natural a manner and making them appear so probable as to deceive us into a persuasion, at least while we're reading, that all is real until we are affected by the joys or distresses of the persons in the story as if they were our own. And another critic usually known as Mrs. Barbauld, argued in her essay on Samuel Richardson that the novel had evolved out of a desire for a closer imitation of nature. Though it preserved the high passion and delicacy of sentiment of the old romance, that wasn't to last all that long, it was superior to the older form precisely because it depicted characters moving in the same sphere of life with ourselves and brought into action by incidents of daily occurrence. Unlike its precursor form, the novel was not concerned with giants and fairies or even princes and princesses, but with people of our acquaintance. And she also identified three types of narration. And you see, this is interesting. These are women who are writing as literary theorists and critics, and they can do so because the novel is in their domain. The novel is the kind of literature that they can relate to. But also, they understand it in and out, and they can talk about it in theoretical terms. So she says, there is the kind in which an author relates the whole adventure, and she says, as in Cervantes' Don Quixote, or in Fielding, in the history of Joseph Andrews. Then, she says, there is the memoir, or first-person account, found in Marivaux, a French novelist from the first half of the 18th century, or Tobias Smollett, Marivaux also in the middle of the 18th century, actually. Tobias Smollett, who wrote in roughly the 1760s, second half of the 18th century in England. So the first-person account. And the epistolary mode, in which characters address one another in letters, which is what Richardson does. Right. Now, Henry Fielding wrote a preface to the history of Joseph Andrews, in which he defined the novel as a comic epic in prose. And I put that section in which he gives the definition of the comic epic in prose on Blackboard, right, if you want to look at it. It's just a few pages, a couple of pages. So Dead Souls, in part, you see, is meant to be a comic epic in prose. So Turgenev is coming from a different side of things, even though both of them use the third-person narrator, and therefore fit Mrs. Barbauld's first category. The epistolary novel, all these have limitations, she says. The authorial mode, the third-person narrator, could seldom become dramatic without the introduction of dialogue. So you have this slightly artificial switch between the third-person and the reported dialogue. And this has to be worked out. The memoir novel made the reader wonder how an imaginary narrator could remember so precisely everything that happened. Right? So this might seem to violate a bit the very realism of the novel itself. The epistolary novel has problems of exposition because you get everything from an individual person's point of view. You get Pamela's letters, you get Mr. B's letter. We're never sure what the rest of his name is in all of this. Fielding, however, spelled it out. He is Mr. Booby in Shambhala. But anyway, Mr. B, we get Mr. B's letters, we get Pamela's letters, we get a few other letters. And the same goes on in Clarissa. But the problem is, how do you get information that's not in the letters of those characters? So there's a problem of exposition. But in the end, Mrs. Barbauld preferred the epistolary novel. So to the other two modes. She says, private letters describing the emotions of characters as they felt them at the moment, because in an epistolary novel, you're in the present. It's not told in the past. You're at the heat of the moment. You follow the story breathlessly, letter by letter by letter. In fact, at one point when Pamela has written what must be at least a 30-page letter, she says, the master is coming. must hide them, and she stuffs them in her bosom, which certainly did nothing to allay Mr. B's lust, one would imagine. All right, so it was during the second half of the 18th century, then, that women critics labored to free the novel from associations with triviality and scandal, and to do that, to give it the dignity of a proper literary form, then, they had to clamp down on any immorality or even suggestion of immorality in the novel. No sex, please, we're British. You know, that's the way it worked. Now, what's interesting, you see, in the Russian novel, because, of course, you can imagine in domestic settings, with private feelings and realism, you have to figure that love is going to be a very prominent motif, but the love has to be very muted and indirectly described. So it was this, then, that takes us into the 19th century, and this kind of propriety is not always maintained, particularly not in the French novel, in a novel like Dangerous Illusions, for example, which some of the ladies were not very pleased with because it portrayed wicked ladies. But by the time we get to the Russian novel, this has shifted to something else. It shifted to politics. And so now it's politics more than sexuality, or shall we say, immodesty. And this means immodesty in behavior as well as in public, as well as in sexual matters. But now it is politics, then, that is the forbidden fruit of the novel. And this gets us right to Turgenev. That's my segue, you might say, because Turgenev, who had had, as Dr. Kellen explained last time, who had had his problems with the authorities, now presents in a highly political novel that got him to, oh my goodness, all kinds of trouble with both sides, left and right. Nevertheless, what he does is to pull back, makes no judgments whatsoever in his characters. The kind of propriety that was demanded of the erotic in the 18th century and in the first decades of the 19th century is now demanded of politics. And with that, I'll stop. Unless, I'm sorry, you had a question way back.
You answered it.
Okay, good for me. You see, I can read minds. Any other questions, though? Okay, I'm going to pass the podium to Dr. Callan.
Thank you, Scott. I'm going to pass out some more stuff here. This was a promised handout, in case you remember from last time.
Forgotten by me.
Which I attributed and justifiably so to our predecessor here in this book. And it does emphasize what I think is so valuable for our course right now, the terrific difference between Gogol and Turgenev, between dead souls and fathers and sons. So what we have is a three-column comparison that allows us to compare dead souls and fathers and sons in several respects. And really, in all these respects, they are opposite, sometimes diametrically opposed, sometimes just two different ways of doing things. We talked about the plot. The Dead Souls plot is episodic and linear and open-ended, whereas Turgenev's plot, Fathers and Sons plot, is organic. We recognize it as having an Aristotelian arc to it. It operates by cause and effect. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Right? Whereas that would clearly hem in Gogol's style much too much to have cause and effect in operation. In terms of method, you know, although we talk about all of these as narratives, you really can identify Dead Souls as narration. That is to say, they're placing the central event in a cosmos of alternating sublimity and degradation by means of digressive comments. The author is always, the author's voice is always there in Dead Souls, mediating and evaluating, so that we never get, we never lose the sense of an event being part of a whole larger context. The method of Fathers and Sons is dramatic, scenic. So he has drawn from what drama has taught about how to expose a story, how to set it and carry it on. Its characters are nobler than life. Not so in Dead Souls, usually. And its characters are also an objectification of states of mind. The narrator of Dead Souls is a limited omniscient, able to see everything that he wants to talk about. Hence he can be digressive, right, with impunity. It's a moralistic narrator. And of course, as you know, he's in quest of Holy Russia. The narrator of Father and Sons is omniscient and effaced, and is not moralistic, as you said, Scott, stands back from making judgments from the actions, shows most of the story, gives it to us to decide, or acts as if he is leaving it to us to decide. Now, if we step back from narrative technique for a minute, we're going to look larger at the concerns of the novel. We'll talk about the enveloping action. We used this term before, as to what is the larger moment in history that's being portrayed in a given work. Always there's something implied. One may or may not have a philosophy of history, be a Hegelian or whatever, but whether or not, it's a common, I think, a common mistake in America to say, oh, I'll leave all that philosophical stuff to others. I have no philosophy of history. I'll just take it as it comes, right? But instead, no, we all have an implied enveloping action around us. And it's certainly far more true of a narrator, of a novelist, writing about a particular sequence of events. So for Dead Souls, it's a Russia in decay. Foreign influences are, as you know, French and terrible things like that, invading a traditional culture and cutting roots, and the mark of those things all being Poshlosts. For Turgenev, writing 20 years later, right, it's not a Russia in decay. Everything, there's a balance in all things. There's a decadent aristocracy and a rising next generation. A next generation with revolutionary ideas, which, however, would destroy civilization along with outmoded ideas. And yet it's taken somehow, it seems, more serenely than Gogol does. Gogol's characters are numerous, not related to each other, right? They're all in a line of whom Chichikov visits, and so forth. They're types. They're portrayed as worse than ordinary. So that's to go back to Aristotle and Aristotle's designation of comedy and versus tragedy in the Poetics. As he said, comedy portrays characters who are worse than ordinary, and tragedy portrays characters better than ordinary. So there is that tonal difference here, exemplified in Gogol and Turgenev. We sense that Gogol's characters are allegorical personages. With Turgenev, we have a sense that they are have greater meaning, but not in an allegorical, forced, intentional, authorially motivated way, but that they seem somehow to embody something out of their surroundings. They're archetypes. They have greater psychic depth that remains untapped. The dialogue that they use doesn't tell their whole story, doesn't tell all about them. Turgenev gives a sense of an iceberg in a character, right, in which so a greater part is submerged. Yes, uh-huh.
Can you talk a little bit about the difference between an archetype and a type?
Okay, I'll try. Well, a type could be many things. I mean, it depends on which vocabulary you're putting the term in. If you use it in an ordinary a dramatist's language or Hollywood language, why it's a character whose dimensions are known or preset. We know what this kind of person does, and so basically somebody's portraying one of that type of person. There are other uses for the term, but maybe that's the one you're thinking of. Archetype, however, sometimes skeptics do equate archetypes and stereotypes, right? But I think they're intended to be quite different. That an archetype, if we follow Jung's notion of the archetype, is an expression of a recurring psychic manifestation, right? Which, as he claimed, dreams tend to show exist as as types of person, right? Represent conflicts that occur within the deep structure of the human race over and over again. Okay.
So could you say basically that a type has more to do with like maybe manners, ways of acting more on the surface. Archetype has something to do with a much more deeper form of the human being.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a type is a social construct.
Okay.
You know, and an archetype is more of a psychological dimension. A hero's part of the archetype, the shop girl's part of the
mm-hmm.
social type.
So when a character does something expected, we tend to move more in that direction of saying, oh, this character might be a type of a certain social role or something. What Turgenev does, it's when Bazarov does something that the most unexpected that we begin to think, there may be some archetypal force he's manifesting here. So, you know, very, very different in that very regard. Was there another question? Comment. So that's characters. And again, you know, how Turgenev